Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Welcome back to Small Caps. My name's Kerry Stevenson, and today, delighted to be speaking with Nigel Ferguson. He's the Managing Director of AVZ Minerals. We're talking massive project over in the Congo. Now, he's going to explain a few things about why this is a very unique project, and you guys need to sit up and take notice. Welcome to the program, Nigel. Great to see you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
You know what? It's great that we've got the technology during these lockdown times, but lockdown hasn't stopped you guys. You've had an amazing 12 months at AVZ. So what I'd like to talk about is your project, which is over in the Congo. And let's just start off by giving our listeners a bit of an overview. We'll dig deep a little bit later, but just a quick overview of the project and its location.
Okay, so we're approximately 500 kilometres north of the town of Lubumbashi in the DRC. It's sort of central to the country on the eastern side. It's based on a historical tin mine around Manono, produced about 90 million cubic metres of material back in its day. But tin fell out of favour, prices down, and we were left with this fantastic spodumene-rich resource. We've completed about 27,500 metres of drilling, concentrated mainly on one area at Roche d'Or, and that's where we've got our 400 million tonnes of resource at 1.65%. So it's without doubt the largest JORC-compliant resource in the world that's not been developed as yet.
Largest resource in the world that has yet to be developed. So how did AVZ come across this project?
Look, we've been looking at the project for quite some time as a tin play. We were quite successful previously in the north, or further north of us, with another project, which was tin. And we were looking for a second tin play. And then, of course, lithium came on the scene and we put two and two together and came up with 12. So that's where Manono came from. We signed it up in December of 2016, moved onto the project with due diligence in 2017 in February. And the rest is history, as they say. We've drilled the resource out and we've completed feasibility studies.
Well, Nigel, some people will say, oh, it's the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. What's that like? Isn't that a little bit tricky to work in? But I understand that you've been working there for quite a number of years and you have a very different view on most people about working there, especially now.
Look, I think if you speak to anybody that's been operating in the country, you would come up with the same answer. And geological risk is pretty much zero. Political risk is everyone's bugbear at the moment. But I have been operating there since about 2004. Had an initial visit into the country back in the late 90s. But since 2004, we've managed to get on with quite a fair bit. Different projects, copper, cobalts, gold projects. And the big boys are there as well. I mean, you've Friedland Group's in there, Ashanti Goldfields, Anglo Gold Ashanti, I should say, Barrick Mines in the north on the Kibali project. So there's a lot of money going in to projects there which are world-class. Kamoa project, the copper project, is massive, and I think that's going to be about a $3 billion investment at the end of the day. I'm pretty sure that Kibali has chewed up somewhere around about $1.5 billion. So people are not afraid of it. Miners are certainly not afraid of it. And I think with the current president, Tshisekedi, he is really sweeping clean. We're seeing a lot of good signs with cleaning up corruption, getting rid of people who shouldn't be in positions that they have been in and have been hand in the till, should we say. But look, it's getting easier. And I think the great thing about Tshisekedi is that he sees that it needs to be cleaned up and he's doing something about it.
And I guess that's where he sees the income for the country and I guess the lifting up of people out of poverty.
Of course. I mean, for example, our project is quite remote and the little town we're in has got 30,000 people, but they live hand to mouth. There's very little industry there. They have the opportunity of benefiting from us developing infrastructure, roads coming into the area. suppliers coming in on the back of those, and hopefully from the back of us, we'll be able to supply some power to the town, or at least the hospital when it's up and running, and administrative blocks, and decent water that they can actually drink out of a tap instead of having to go down to the river and collect it from there. So yeah, I mean, it's all part of our ethos is to put back into the community because they're stakeholders as well.
And you've started a two questions here. You started a foundation, I believe. That's the first question. But also, are the local people supportive of you guys coming into their area? And have you been able to explain what you're doing to them? I guess they're going to be getting jobs and lifting them themselves out of poverty.
Yeah, no, exactly. So the foundation has been set up, and that's its intention is to siphon a bit of profit out of the company and throw that back into the community. We've talked to quite a few NGOs already that are interested in combining with us to do that. With regards to locals, I mean, a lot of locals have been, as I've said, living hand to mouth. They operate small little farms that basically supply them with supplies for a period of time. But our idea is that we want to engage with them. There's artisanal miners there. For example, we had a requirement to upgrade some drainage systems in historical drainage systems that have been used to get rid of standing water. So we had an employment day and we had something like 1,000 of them turn up looking for a job. We took on 350 of them, put them to work with pick and shovel, and they cleaned out the roads. They cleaned out these gutters, the drainage systems. And as a result, we've got less standing water and less incidence of malaria in the area as well. Plus 3 months of work for these guys to put some money in their back pocket and pay for food. So, and that will continue. We're looking to roll those people over. Labor laws are a little bit archaic in that if you come on board for 3 months, you're expected to be an employee of the company. And at our stage as an exploration developer, we really can't take on 1,000 employees. So down the track, we'll find a way of bringing them on. More importantly, they might set up their own cooperative and become part of the mining crew down there as well.
That's a lovely part of the story. I do like. I love the human side of mining, and I love to explain to listeners that, you know, miners don't just go into an area and, you know, rip the stuff out of the ground. Actually, it is really good for those people that have had nothing in the past, and you're giving them, so lifting them out of poverty. But I want to go more into the project now, because earlier this year, you attained a pretty significant milestone with your DFS, your definitive feasibility study. What did that show you? What were some of the headline numbers, and why did you get so pretty excited about that DFS?
Yeah, still excited about it. It's just a massive project. I mean, we limited ourselves to 20 years of modelling mine life, but the numbers are just ridiculous. Based on forecasts that we engaged with consultants to find out where that pricing would be when we were in production, and that's the general gist of what we've done. But, you know, $2.4 billion of an NPV10 and 53% return on your money is pretty damn good. We throw about $4 billion back into the system in tax over the 20-year mine life. We've only got 60% of the project, but at present we've got 60%. We've paid for that. We're well and truly secured on that. But just recently you will have seen a couple of announcements, one more recently than the other, securing an extra 15% in the project for a total of $20 million. So,
okay, I'm going to stop you for a second, Nigel, because some people won't know that, and some people won't know the background to that. So let's just take a step back and say you currently have 60%.
Correct.
How does who's got the other 40? Let's unpack that a little bit, and then let's move forward as to what's going to happen in the future.
Certainly. So we're at 60%, as you've mentioned. Cominyair, which is a parastatal, a state government entity, was sitting at 30%, and the remaining 10% was with a private company from Kinshasa, which was essentially a mining magnate that was looking at licenses around the place, and he facilitated bringing the project to the table for us. So we've gone on from there to invest in the project and earn our 60%. Whilst that was happening, we were concentrating all of our funds on the exploration and development. And Cominyair, the government, were looking for some additional cash. So they sold 5% to this third party, Dathomir. Dath and Mayor, at the end of the day, have always, and we've had first right of refusal over the remaining equity percentage in the project, not only from Dath and Mayor, but also from Commonair. So we've got two agreements in place now where we've purchased, we've put a deposit down, but we have a period of time to purchase the remaining 15% from Dath and Mayor. And we've got 12 months to run on the second agreement, which we think is pretty good timing considering we're looking at the financing of the project at the moment. And that will end up with us having 75% of the project. And I think, you know, the pricing of it has been pretty damn cheap, to be honest. $20 million to get 15% of the project is a steal. Nobody will get that same price at the end of the day. But so that's it. That's where it's at the moment. 75% is where we expect to be, plus the opportunity of going a little bit higher on the back of that with a deal with the government.
And that 75% is in about 12 months' time, is that correct?
Yeah, the first agreement was a three-year term. The second agreement was a 12-month term, knowing that we were closer to finance decision. So we're quite comfortable with that. Believe we'll be able to raise the cash if we need to do it and get it across the line. So, yeah, that's no problem. 12 months, probably March next year.
That's not far away. Are you able, Nigel, to talk a little bit about the funding and how and what that looks like, and also how are you going to fund this project? Because this is the largest project in the world for lithium. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a massive resource. I mean, 400 million tonnes, reserves of 93 million tonnes, but that's all going to change in a little while. We'll talk about the wedge underneath the pit in a minute. But look, we need $550 million for a DMS plant, a sulphate plant and associated infrastructure related to the hydro scheme. That's about a $48 million fit out. And then we've got roads and a barge that we need to build, et cetera, et cetera. So there's quite a few things in there. So $550 million in total, and then working capital over the top of that, which we've already committed $60 million to the project. So there's probably another $60 million required. With regards to negotiations on the financing side of things, we're pretty well advanced. We've got a lot of people sitting in the database at the moment, the virtual database. A lot of them are very interested in the project. We've had some verbal commitments. We've had some written commitments, but not binding. So we're probably sitting roughly at 50% of what we require. There are one or two left field offers that have come in for the entire amount, but we're pushing back on that at the moment. We don't believe that's in the best interest of our shareholders, and we can do a better deal on it, basically, we think. So they're up for negotiation. So, and the number of people who are actually knocking on our door now saying, is there a chance for us to look at investing in this, is growing every day. The Arabs are starting to jump on board. We've got the Qataris and the Saudis and the Emiratis who are interested. Out of the UK and Europe, we're seeing more interest there as well on the back of the expansion of the battery manufacturing industry in Europe. And, of course, from China, Southeast Asia, we're also seeing interest. So there's a lot happening in that space, and I'm pretty confident.
Juggling a few there, but I also, you mentioned Europe. You've recently been accepted as a member of the European Battery Alliance. Now, that was an organisation which was launched by the European Commission, I believe.
That's correct.
Is that because I guess lithium is becoming a critical material. Is that important to the company to be accepted as a member of that?
Yeah, of course it is. And you're quite right. It has recently been listed as a critical mineral for Europe. And I think they're gradually seeing that they need to have more because they're seeing supply of critical minerals being gobbled up by the Chinese and controlled by the Chinese, and they just don't like the idea of that. So, look, Europe is almost the same time zone as our project. We have a lot of ties into to Europe as well, historically, with shareholders as well. There's quite a few German and Swiss shareholders in the company. And we believe that that's an area that we can certainly surpass other suppliers of lithium and possibly hydroxide in the future. We're closer to it. There are some players in Europe, but I think their resources are quite limited, quite small. But we've got a long-term supply chain there that we can obviously jump on the back of and supply European battery manufacturers for quite some time into the future. And I don't think this is a fly-by-night method of motorising vehicles, shall we say. I think it's going to continue for quite some years until a new technology is found, probably 30 or 40 years at least. But there we go.
There's two things that you mentioned. First of all, just a little while ago, you said that it is quite remote. So I want to talk about the infrastructure and why, and is it going to be easy for you to get the material to customers? And are you looking at offtake at this stage?
Most definitely looking at offtake. I mean, that's critical for our financing. If we don't have offtake, we can't pay back the money we've lent. So we are well advanced with product offtake agreements. We've got nothing signed up as yet, but they are certainly well advanced. So we've got three, in fact, that we're looking to sell. We've got the SC6, the spodumene concentrate, 6%. We've got about 555,000 tonnes of that per annum. Then we have the lithium sulfate, a primary lithium sulfate, which is essentially the first step of a hydroxide or a carbonate process, where you produce a powdered lithium sulfate, which is running anywhere 82 to 85% roughly. And then the final product for us is the historical tin content of the project, which is still available to us when we pull it out as a byproduct. Yeah. And there's a bit of tantalum in there as well. So tin, we have a group that's very interested in taking 100% of our offtake. It's not a huge amount of revenue for us. It's only about 5% of our revenue stream. But they're very keen on having the whole lot. And they're also looking at investing in the equipment and mining equipment to do that as a separate sort of structure to the main mining scenario. And then we've got the SC6 product. We're looking at probably being around about 80% of that being under negotiation at the moment. So we're pretty comfortable that we're going to get that done. The primary lithium sulfate is a different kettle of fish, because not too many people have been on the bandwagon of selling that as a product. And that's come out of need. Necessity for us, because it reduces the number of tons that we actually transport on the roads and rail to get it out to the buyers. But essentially that would take the front end of a hydroxide or a carbonate plant away from someone who's wanting to build a plant. It saves them on capex costs. It saves them on getting rid of the waste products, because we've got plenty of space to put the waste products. But it also assists us in getting rid of probably 50% or maybe even a bit more of the actual tons that need to be transported along the railway systems. The buyers of that product are wanting to see what it is, because it's a new idea. So we've got test work underway at the moment in Canada to produce exactly that, a sulfate, and then we'll get the full chemical analysis of it, and we can provide that to any of the buyers that are interested in it. That should be another 2 or 3 weeks, I think, before we get the final. They've produced a raw material, which is looking very, very good. So we're just waiting on the final nod and obviously the internal review, so that we can put a press release out to that effect. And then hopefully the sulfate buyers will be sitting at the table saying, yep, okay, now we understand it, we can move ahead with it.
So there is a lot going on. You're also, you mentioned earlier that there was some drilling going on at the moment on the pit floor. Was there, I think you called it a wedge?
Yes, there is. Yes, I called it the wedge. That's the internal name for it. It is basically, it's a wedge shape. So historically, when we were drilling the resource, the pit at Roche Dor was flooded, as all of the pits are there. So we couldn't get underneath it. We just couldn't get the right angle on the drilling to be able to do anything. We didn't want to go to the expense of doing directional drilling. So we said, let's just wait until we finish our resource, and then we can go back in when the pit has been dewatered. We dewatered the pit over the course of about 5 months. Ended up in, I think it was March, April of this year. And we've just managed to open borders and get a drill rig back up to site. Although the drill rig was there, it was the crew and the consumables, et cetera, that were required. And I think they're just about to finish their first drill hole. So the idea is that we want to put sufficient number of holes within that wedge, which is inferred category, so the lowest category of JORC resources, and bring it up into indicated category. And by doing that, we'll obviously increase, and it's about 10 million tonnes, but we'll increase the measured indicated resources by about 10 million tonnes, no surprise there. But the biggest bonus for us is that that 10 million tonnes has previously been treated as waste. So instead of having some sort of payback for pulling it out of the ground and sticking it through the mill, we've just been dumping it on the side as waste, knowing full well that it was going to be ore at the end of the day. So now it becomes ore. We get earlier cash flow. It goes straight to the plant. We will probably see a reduction in the stripping ratio, which is already brilliant at the moment. It's just on 0.5 to a ton of waste to one ton of ore. It'll probably go down to 0.3.
Wow. Is that unheard of, Nigel? That seems awfully low, 0.5, 0.3.
It is if you start mining from surface. It's pretty normal, I would think. If you're straight into ore at surface, if you've got a narrow deposit that needs to be chased down 400 or 500 metres, then obviously the wider you go on the cutback, the more waste you have to dig out of the ground. So we're very fortunate that this deposit is 250 metres wide, about 220 metres thick. So we've already got a very large working face that we can take ore straight out of. So that's why we wanted to do this drilling was, one, it reduces our stripping ratio a little bit more, but more importantly, it gets rid of the cost associated with just mining it as waste. The other part that really comes through is that we increase our mine life by approximately 5 years on the numbers. The reserves will probably go up from about 93 million tonnes at the moment to maybe 140 million tonnes. And our payback period comes down as well. So it's already pretty good at 2.25 years post-tax, but that'll bring it back down a bit more than that. So, yeah, look, it's all good. I mean, I can't complain about it. It's one of the most...
Nigel, is this one of the best projects you've worked on in? Because you had a long career in the resources industry, working in the Congo and working in various jurisdictions, but also in various commodities. Is this one taking you by surprise at all?
Look, the size, just as an indication, when I first went to site to have a look at it, I flew in on a plane thinking that I was going to be there for 5 hours and then turn around and come back out with half a dozen samples in my hand. I had to go back to the pilot and say, can you come back in 3 days' time? I need to walk the whole length of it. So, look, from a geological point of view and from a geologist's point of view, you probably get one chance to work on a project that's world-class, if you're lucky. You might get the chance of discovering a deposit, but it might be, you know, 5,000 ounces of gold somewhere in the middle of nowhere, or it might be 400 million tonnes of lithium. But this is, or sorry, 400 million tonnes of resource of lithium. But this is not a new discovery by any means. It's a historical mine site. We knew the pegmatites were there, but just to be associated with it is incredible. It's just changing. The geology is not challenging to any degree. But to be associated with the size of this thing and how much impact it's going to have is it's a pleasure.
I want to ask you two more questions because I know that for the benefit of our audience, I really want to you to share with us, because the lithium market, it's had a bit of a tough time. What's your view on the lithium market right now? Increasing?
Look, I think the last 2 years have been absolute hell, to be honest.
At least he's honest, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, no, the price has been absolute rubbish. We know that there's been a downturn. Everybody's been hit by it in the lithium sector. It's improving. The price might not be, but I see there's a huge renewed interest in lithium and batteries. The more green you go, the better you go, I suppose, is what we're saying at the moment, and we're trying to be as green as we can. But
when you say you're trying to be as green as you can, how does that work?
Well, I mean, we're investigating. Well, we do have Pyhtanamwanga Hydro Facility, which is down the road from us, which will supply us with hydropower, renewable energy for however long we need it. We've got enough supply there to cater for the plant design as it is at the moment, with a bit of expansion. It'll run the campsite for us without any issues. There'll be extra power there to be able to put back into the grid for the use in the local town at Monono. So hopefully the main sort of assets of the hospital and maybe the schools or the runway or the administrative blocks will get some power. From the back of that, we're pretty keen and have started investigations quite some time ago on electric equipment. So the light vehicles, the typical old Tojo four-wheel drive that you have running around the place, we're looking at having electric versions of those. We know they're available. They can be retrofitted. It's going to be something we'll have on site without any doubt. When it comes to the heavier equipment, the trucks, they're starting to become more available. And then the issue was always you needed a larger truck, and it didn't fit with what we wanted to do with the mining side of things. So now the manufacturers are realizing they need to go smaller trucks, you know, 50-ton trucks instead of 150 tons, but have them electric. So we're investigating that. We've had pretty good conversations with some of the suppliers. Shovels as well, excavators, the same sort of thing. So we're expecting to be able to get up to high 90s on electrical use eventually. We'll still have to have some backup there. We've also got the calcine plant, which needs diesel generators to get the temperature required to calcinate. So we're of the opinion that we can offset whatever we're shortfalling on the hydropower with planting, basically. We'll put some reforestation projects into play and get that up and running. So we'll be pretty green at the end of the day. I think that's the big push from everybody at the moment.
That's great. Well done, you. We're running out of time, Nigel, so I just want to ask you one final thing, which is a lot of investors watching us chatting away here. Why AVZ? Why now? What would your final thoughts be to those that are not yet invested with AVZ but are looking very closely?
Okay. So, look, I think the major thing is the quality of the asset, the quality of the product we're going to be producing. We don't have any issues with getting the product out. We've investigated that completely. So those concerns are gone now. It's a long-term approach that we're taking. It's a quality project. It will be in production, and it will be supplying a hell of a lot of material to the European and Chinese factories, I think, in the near future. So we're on the cusp of financing. Once that comes on board, it's all stops out. We'll be pushing as hard as we can.
Nigel Ferguson, they're very good to talk with you today, and I look forward to seeing how you're going in March next year, if not before.
Lovely. Thanks very much.